Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you to Michigan to speak with Paul Templer, philanthropist, adventurer, motivational speaker, and former safari guide. Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
Kira, thank you so much for inviting me to come and speak with you.
I'm really excited to talk with you. So I want to start because, I mean, I almost feel like your story goes so far back to even when you were just growing up as a child. So can you just start by telling us what it was like? You grew up in Africa, and then you went around the world, and you came back home. What was that like, and what drew you back?
Sure. Like you say, I did grow up in Africa, little country, which was at that time called Rhodesia. It's now called Zimbabwe. And so when I grew up in the middle of a civil war. So life was fairly hectic, but through a young kid's eyes, it was fascinating. I spent most of my time in the great outdoors. On the one hand, my dad was in the military, so surrounded by army guys and gals. And on the other hand, surrounded by all the wildlife. So that was home. Got to learn early on kind of how I fitted into it all. Once the early formative years had passed, I set off, as many people from that part of the world do, to travel the world and try and figure out what's next, and spend a lot of time traveling through Europe, the Middle East, Asia, the Americas. And it was fascinating. It was intriguing, but it wasn't home. And there was this constant pull to go back home, go back home, go back home. And so after spending a few years gallivanting around the globe, I spent a little while serving with the British Army in the middle of all of that. I went back home and decided to go to where and what I loved and went and entered the safari industry.
Wow. And so tell us about that. How long were you leading safaris? What was that experience like? And then I know that there was a situation with a hippo that really changed your whole life. And if you're comfortable telling our listeners about that, we would love to hear it.
Sure. So all told, outside of training, probably spent 7 years leading safaris. And you know what? It was absolutely fabulous. The beautiful thing with being a licensed guide in Zimbabwe, and my focus was on photographic safaris, was that there's this really in-depth training program that they put us all through before they let us take clients out into the wild. And so we spent a lot of time at the beginning of our careers. It was something that was sponsored by the Professional Hunters and Guides Association and the Department of National Parks. But you would develop both an academic in-depth awareness and knowledge of the flora and the fauna and how it all worked together, as well as an experiential side where you would go on safaris and learn firsthand about the animals, how they interacted with the environment, and not just the animals, the trees, the bugs, the birds, just how it all connected and tied together. And with that came just a growing appreciation and awareness for the incredible value that we could derive from the wild, as well as a degree and an element of responsibility on what we needed to give back to protect that. Working firsthand inside of that environment, got to see just how fragile it was.
Yeah, and so when you were guiding, how did you want to translate that to the people that you were taking on these trips? Like, what were you hoping that they would come to understand that you now understood about that fragility?
So the beautiful thing with taking people out on safaris is the vast majority of folks who came out on safari were international. They came from overseas. So a lot of them were arriving in Africa with a number of preconceived notions about what they were going to be doing, how they were going to be doing it, where they were going to be going, what they were going to be seeing. I think, and this is based on feedback from thousands of folks who I had the pleasure and privilege of taking on safari, few of them expected the experience of actually slowing down and connecting with the environment. So we typically, a typical safari would start with you'd meet your clients beforehand. My personal preference, my very strong preference, was river safaris. So canoeing, kayaking, rafting. And the duration of the trips would be anywhere from a few hours to 11 days that you would be out in the wild. From totally backed up, where you would have camps and camp staff, and to the other extreme, where you would load all your equipment into a canoe and disappear into the wild for a week plus. So it didn't seem to matter which end of the spectrum it was. When folks arrived, just being exposed to, introduced to, and exposed to stuff they just read about and heard about, getting up close and personal to some of the more spectacular, no, I shouldn't say more spectacular wildlife, more pronounced wildlife, getting close to an elephant and getting to see not just, whoa, there's an elephant, they're huge, but getting to see, oh, there's a herd of elephant, and look, it's a matriarchal society, and look how they take care of their young, and look at the symbiotic relationship between those and the oxpeckers, and then see how the baboons sit in the tree, and when they see the elephants come. So you got to unravel this this tapestry, and people, it's one thing to care about it and then imagine it, but it's another thing to be so immersed in it. And when people would arrive from overseas, the first thing that you would see being affected by being on safari or being in the wild was their nervous system. You would see them getting out of their heads and into their bodies. And the experience would unfold, and they would get to see how it was also interconnected. And then it would be inevitable, because you would come across human encroachment. And it would suddenly go from this concept about this impact that humans have on the environment, on the wildlife, to, whoa, now I can actually see it. When people would arrive, often they would arrive with absolutes. Human encroachment is bad. Preserving the wildlife is good. And wouldn't see that there's ways that that dance can be managed in ways that work really well for both, and that there are ways for both to engage with each other. So I'm not going to kid you. A lot of a safari was about excitement and being entertained and being enthralled and being blown away, because the majesty and just everything out there is so spectacular. But I would say the vast majority of my clients would say, yes, a lot of those were the stories they would talk about when they went home. But there were also the calm moments when they would sit looking at a dung beetle do its thing and then connecting the dots on how that led to sustainability of the whole environment.
This is going to sound really silly, but it almost sounds to me like they get to shed their humanness and become more animal. Does that make sense? Like, we're shedding all of this extra stuff that got added to humanity with technology and working and all these different things, and somehow brings us back more to our actual animal selves?
I don't think that sounds silly at all, Kara. I think that's you've articulated it very clearly and quite succinctly there. I think it's that and that connection, that oneness of how we're all so incredibly interconnected. And in the absence of being able to step out of that busyness of our, I'm going to say Western, but I think globally, out of the modern mind, the modern world, the modern body, unless we can step out of that, we're not going to be able to even see it, let alone become aware of it, let alone appreciate it, let alone enjoy it, let alone benefit from it, or even contribute towards its betterment. And I think, to me, one of the very coolest things that I would see at the end of a safari, and when I say see, I could see it in their bodies. You would just see their bodies were so much more relaxed, the way they would engage. You know, that people would be more present with whoever they had arrived on safari with. When you would see a family, they would be more connected, more open to each other. If it was a group who didn't know each other, you could see that different level of connectivity that I didn't attribute to, well, they just spent a few days together. It was more they allowed themselves to slow down and actually connect with each other and, as importantly, connect with what they all cared about. Wildlife has an incredible way of bringing that into the foreground.
That's really moving to hear. It's lovely. So on the flip side of that, what have you seen that's been maybe shocking or appalling when people come into these situations for this experience? Is there anything you've seen that was really particularly upsetting, or people just acting really inappropriately? And did that then change as the experience went on?
So, Kara, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, part of me giving huge kudos to our training, the training program that we had on safari, becoming a safari guide, was one of the key elements is how to connect with people, right? So quite often folks would get off the airplane, walk out of their hotel, wherever it was you were meeting them, and they would come under this misnomer that the wild and the wildlife was there to entertain them. And there was a very clear and apparent lack of respect for the environment. There was this certainty that people would show up with that they were right and they knew what they were going to do. And then one of the best bits of advice I got when I first started taking people out on safari was kind of meet people where they're at, because it was really, real easy to get into judgment with folk. I can't tell you the number of people who I've caught, they would throw a wrapper of a film canister on the ground.
Oh, wow.
But what would happen then? It seems incredibly trivial, but it's reflective of a mindset, right? So what I learned very early on is there's a real respectful way to say, you know, that doesn't work out here. Go and pick it up. When you would get people who would be making, you would have spent a whole lot of time creeping up on a hide or creeping up on a group of animals, and then people would start speaking loudly and disturbing the wildlife or breaking up a hunt that was unfolding before their eyes. You could get to point it out to them in a way that, you know what, here's an environment that you have the opportunity to respect and engage with, or you can show up the way you're showing up with. And you know what, my guess is if you're throwing garbage out here, if you're being disrespectful of the animals and each other's experience of this, then odds are that's probably how you're showing up back home too, huh? So the wild became this incredible classroom because it reflected back on people who they were. So as a guide, my job was to do it in a way where I wasn't a complete ass, but let them see themselves.
Wow. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It reminds me of when I went to Auschwitz and the experience of watching tourists show up at this just place of absolute humility and, you know, talk about where they're going for dinner that night while we're walking through the gas chambers, and that like just complete disconnect between how do you respect the space that you're in for what it is and what it deserves of you, and just having no concept of how to show up like that.
Absolutely. And I think people's inability to or maybe it's not inability, lack of awareness of the symbiotic relationship between how they show up and what shows up to them in the environment. That was one of the things that became really apparent taking people on safari all the time. And was part of, that was one of the great gifts that a lot of them took from safari.
Yeah, oh, I bet. I mean, how amazing to have that shift happen. Because I'm sure it's not like these people realize they're doing it. This is just what they've been conditioned in their experience and to have that metamorphosis happen from this is what I've been doing and not even realizing I was doing it and moving through that to, oh my gosh, this has actually transformed my view. I mean, that's really important work that you were doing.
Absolutely. And Kerry, you make a great point there. I've been back on Safari since being immersed on it. I've gone back after being away for a while, and I've caught myself sometimes being the ugly tourist. I've become conditioned. I've become impatient. I've become less than respectful of the environment. So I'm certainly not not blaming or being necessarily derisive about how people show up. It was more just, it was interesting on how we can get so conditioned in the environments we live in, if we live somewhere like in the West, sometimes going back to somewhere where we can get grounded, we can see ourselves for who we are, that can be a priceless gift.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that you had this incident with a hippo, and that has really changed the course of the work that you do, and you're now a motivational speaker. So I'd love to have our listeners hear about that experience and for you to just share with us how that experience took you on the path that you're on now.
Sure. Kerry, at the time when I had my bad day at the office, I guess we could call it, I was running a river safari, actually, on the day it happened, on the mighty Zambezi River just above Victoria Falls. And it's a beautiful stretch of river, prolific wildlife, and it's just gorgeous. The scenery there is spectacular. And these trips were incredible. You'd set off mid-afternoon, and the idea was you would drift down the river towards Victoria Falls. We would time it so you'd get to the falls just around sunset. So as you're getting nearer, you can see the mist rising, you can hear it, the light softening, and you're just surrounded by this incredible flora and fauna. It's just beautiful. And talk about an immersion. It was great. Now, there was also a hint of luxury to it, because the trip was actually called the Royal Drift. The clients would be drifting down. There'd be two clients and a guide to a canoe. So you'd be sitting in single file. And the guide in the back would have a tray of snacks and a cooler box. And clients would literally just sit there munching on snacks and sipping on drinks and just really letting themselves go. And I was the guide in charge that day. And we were going down, and everything was going kind of according to plan, which is one of the red flags in the wild, right? Some of the best advice I ever got on running safaris was always expect the next animal you see to do everything you've ever read or heard it'll never do. And that's kind of what happened next, is we came across this pod of hippos. They were just sitting there, sunning themselves, wallowing in the shallows. And so I was chatting to the clients, telling them all about hippos. And, of course, there's always the one person who's researched the animal, and they'll go, is it true hippos kill more people every year than any other animal? So the answer to that is yes. And then they would marvel at the size and the strength of them. We'd come on safari that day onto a Land Rover. And I can remember one of the clients couldn't get their head around the fact that the hippo was about the same length as our Land Rover from tip to tail and weighed about twice of what the Land Rover did. So we're getting into this conversation around hippos, and it's time to take a detour. As a guide, you know how to get around these situations safely. Follow the water, read it, and stick to the shallows, and you should be good to go. So I did that. I asked the rest of the canoes to follow me, and there were three canoes on the river that day, and then we had a safety kayaker, and two of the canoes went where they were supposed to be, and the third one cut a corner, and the first thing I knew about that was I was just drifting along, and there was this, this huge thud behind me, and turned just in time to see the back of the canoe flying up into the air, and the guide at the back of the canoe, his name was Evans, flying through the air and splashing into the river. Now, I was a little confused because I had seen a pod of hippo. I could see a female hippo and its calf. And so having this lone, what was clearly a male, just because by the size of him, sitting there just made no sense to me. Anyway, I didn't have time to try and figure that out because I needed to get the guide, Evans, who was in the river, out of the water. So fortunately, when his canoe had landed, it had landed upright. So the two clients in the canoe were like wobbling around. So I sent one of the other guides in to get them out. And I went to try and rescue Evans. So paddling backwards quite feverishly, like, hang in there, I'm coming to get you. And when I say backward, I was paddling backwards because I wanted to keep the clients as far away from the hippos as I could. And was about maybe 10 feet away from Evans when I saw this bow wave just cruising in towards me, kind of like a torpedo. And that's not a good sign. But fortunately, as a guide, you'd learned if something's charging in, just slap the water with the flat of your paddle, makes a loud percussion, and will usually turn whatever's coming at you around. So did that, and the wave stopped just before it got to me. So I thought, okay, I've got some time. Evans was there, leant over. It was kind of a made-for-TV moment. Our fingers almost touching. I'm trying to pull him in. When suddenly my whole world just went dark and quiet. I had no idea what happened. A very few seconds ticked by, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. And I couldn't. Like I said, I had no idea. All I knew was that from my waist up, I wasn't dry, but I wasn't wet either, not like what my legs were. And there was this incredible pressure crushing down on my lower back. So I'm struggling to break free, and I can't really do much. And somehow I managed to get one of my hands, because my arms are pinned to my side, to feel around, and I felt the bristles on the hippo's snout. At least now I knew where I was. I was head first up to my waist down a hippo's throat.
Wow.
That was, it was a little strange. What to me, when I look back in retrospect, was even stranger was the incredible relief I felt because I knew I was not somewhere good. My bigger fear had been that I was up to my waist down a crocodile's throat. It just shows the absurdity of the situation.
Yeah, so you were like, okay, thank goodness, I'm just in a hippo's mouth.
That was the absurdity of it, followed very quickly by, oh, I got to get out of here.
Oh, gosh, I'm in a hippo's mouth. This is a problem.
Right. Talk about thank goodness for the mind overriding itself and going into survival mode, right?
Yes.
So, I'm like trying to wiggle out and nothing. The hippo has got such an incredibly tight bite on me that nothing I do has any effect on him whatsoever. I can only imagine at the time I weighed probably about 200 pounds, was in pretty good shape, and I'm wedged that far down his throat that it was probably pretty uncomfortable. Anyway, he starts thrashing about and then opens his mouth wide enough for me to escape. So I burst to the surface, suck in a lung full of fresh air, and I came face to face with Evans, the guy I was trying to rescue. I'm like, we got to get out of here. So I turn and I start swimming. The rest of the clients and our safety kayaker, a friend of mine, Matt, they're sitting on this cluster of rocks in the middle of the river, and I can see them and heading towards them, and then I get the sixth sense that all's not well. So I turn, and Evan's not going anywhere. He's right where I'd left him. His eyes, quite literally, I mean, they look like saucers as he struggled to stay afloat. I think terror and panic had overwhelmed him. So I turned and swam back for him, and I was just moving in for your classic lifesaver's hold when, wham, I was hit from below. So once again, I'm up to my waist down the hippo's throat, but this time my legs are trapped. My hands are free. So I went for my gun. I used to carry a 357 Magnum revolver with me just in case something like this ever happened. It was for protection for the clients. The hippo was thrashing me around so hard that I never came close to getting a hold of the gun. In fact, all I really accomplished during that phase of the attack was to almost drown. Anyway, the hippo spits me out again. This time when I break the surface, I look around and no sign of Evans. Think, whew, thank goodness, that means either Mac or Ben, the other guy, must have rescued him. So now I figure it's time I need to get out of there. So I'm swimming along. The guys who were there said I was actually pretty good form. I'm swimming freestyle and I'm making pretty good progress. And I come up for a stroke and I'm looking under my arm, and I see the hippo charging towards me, his mouth wide open before scoring a direct hit. This time he bites down on me, my arms, head and shoulders out of one side of his mouth, and my pretty much from my knees, judging by the scars and stuff, knees down to my feet outside the other. And then he goes Magoo. I mean, he just went crazy. For me, everything kind of broke down to slow motion. When we went underwater, I would hold my breath. When we were on the surface, I would suck in air. And all the while, I'd try to hold on to the tusks that were boring through me just so my flesh didn't tear me so much when he shook me all about. One of the clients later said that it was kind of like watching a vicious dog trying to rip apart a rag doll. For me, it was kind of crazy. I remember at one point, he threw me up into the air just with this incredible power and did this half twist. This little picture, it's like it's happening in slow motion. When I fell back into his mouth, he caught me and then just bit down so hard, I thought for sure he's going to chomp me in half. But he didn't. And after a while, he stopped and just dove for deep water. And this led to quite possibly the most surreal moment of my life. I remember laying at the bottom of the river. We were in maybe 6 to 10 feet of water. And there I am, lying wedged inside the hippo's mouth. And I'm looking up, and I can see the different hues of green and yellow and the sunlight that's shimmering on the water's surface. And I remember thinking to myself, I wonder who can hold their breath the longest. And then looking and seeing like blood mingling with the water and wondering which would happen first, if I'd bleed to death or if I'd drown. There was an incredible calmness with that, almost like an acceptance, I guess. Anyway, in the middle of my musings, the hippo like surged towards the surface and flung me out again. This time when my head came up, I saw the front of Mac, the safety kayaker's little red kayak in front of me, and Mac, just showing incredible bravery, risked his life to save mine. He paddled into the fray. I managed to grab a hold of the handle on the boat's nose, and somehow or other, with the hippo just going nuts, he managed to drag me to the safety of the rocks.
Wow. I'm sort of speechless. It's like such an incredible story.
It was an interesting afternoon at work.
Yeah, that's like the understatement of the century. So, am I right? Evans didn't make it, is that correct?
No, they found his body about 3 days after the attack. Apparently he drowned. Yeah.
So, having had this just life-changing experience in this place that you love, in this realm that you're passionate about, like, did that change anything for you in terms of the genuine desire to bring people into this space, did it change how you engage with the wild? I mean, what was the fallout of this experience in terms of the relationship you have with wildlife, wildlife conservation, you know, all of those things? Because I feel like something like that could take you in a billion different directions. Which direction did it take you in?
It's a great question. So when I got to the hospital, there were apparently 38 major bites in my body, and the surgeon thought he was going to have to take off both arms and one leg. And incredible surgeon, he ended up just having to take off one arm. And the initial recovery period, I was angry, I felt guilty. I mean, Evan's safety and well-being had been my responsibility, and now he was dead. I blamed Evans, I blamed the hippo, I blamed myself. I was kind of a hot mess. But fortunately, the environment, working with a lot of guides, and they were a lot of my dearest friends and folks in the industry, and I have an incredible family and friends support system. It didn't take too long to get back onto an even keel. And, you know, the one thing that I think I've always been fortunate about from day one is the hippo did what hippos do. I was the one encroaching on its territory. It's not a blame game. It's the hippo did what hippos do. And I was doing what I did. My intent, taking people into that area, paying clients. Yes, there's a commercial side to it. The business was making money, but a lot of that money got put back into the environment. This was as close to a no-fault incident that I could imagine. The river that I was attacked on, the Zambezi, had never been canoed source to sea. So I was fortunate that I met a prosthetist. We were looking to get me a prosthetic arm, who, in conversation with him, we figured out that he could build me a kayak paddle. So about 2 years after my run-in with that hippo, I led what at the time was the fullest ascent of the Zambezi River to date. It took us 3 months to cover almost 1,600 miles. And the part we skipped was in Angola because of a war zone. But, and this is getting to answering your question. So when I first got back into the canoe, every time a hippo snorted, my body would just freak out.
Sure.
So yeah, getting back into the environment, it was truly a deep immersion. So got back into the wild, got back into the whole safari mode. And the beauty with that trip was I got to see nature at its finest. And traversing the entire Zambezi from source to sea, got to see the difference between where people engage with the environment respectfully and where people don't, because you can see its impact as clear as night and day. So I'd say coming out of the other side of that whole experience, probably a deeper understanding of how we can and do, should and shouldn't interact with the environment. And bottom line, it was almost like nature was giving me a swan song, because it just getting immersed in the beauty and the majesty and I mean, the hippo attack points to it. There's a savagery that goes with that, but that's just part of how that game plays out, which I guess is part of how life plays out. Right.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the work you're doing now, because I know you've moved into motivational speaking. You have a book. I would love for our listeners to know more about what you're doing now.
Once I finished with that expedition, I'd set up a foundation. I was lucky as an amputee. I could get prosthetic support. There were a lot of kids in Africa at the time. That was our focal area, who were stepping on landmines, who didn't have that luxury. So the foundations evolved over the the last number of years. And if there was some good that came out of the whole HIPPO attack, it was the ability to get that stood up. At the same time, I met and fell in love with an American woman. And so I came to live in America. And unfortunately, there wasn't a huge demand for one-arm safari guides in Detroit. So
no, not so much.
It led to a bit of a change in course. Fortunately, though, my life pre-HIPPO attack, I had done a lot of work and been a part of a lot of real high-performing teams, be it in the military, be it leading first descents, expeditions, safaris. And so I got into the world of optimal human performance. And through just the generosity of a lot of people and learning a lot along the way, I've got to build a fairly, I would call it successful consulting practice, where we take what I learned in the wild and apply it to business environments. The very tenets that got me through my bad day at the office or got us through a lot of safaris seem to apply to the business world. And as you mentioned, on top of that, I have the privilege of being invited to come and speak at conferences as a keynote speaker. And I've had some books published. There was the book you mentioned. I've got autobiography, What's Left of Me. I thought it was an apropos title. And I also had the privilege of Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits guy. Mm-hmm. I got to co-author a book on success in business and in life. And again, to take a lot of what I'd learned in the wild and how to apply it to basically to business and to life. And I guess the lesson I learned, the most salient way of pointing at it is, when you'd sit on safari, I would always talk to clients about, hey, take a moment to be grateful. Like, stop all the noise and just, what can you see to be grateful for here? And then, how can you be kind? And then, what's the next right thing? It seemed to work on safari. That strategy seems to work in business. That strategy seems to work in life. So I really have to thank the wildlife and the environment for giving me just an incredible life whilst I was out there leading safaris, but letting me take what I learned there into the world I live in today.
Mm-hmm. So those four steps, if you were going to apply those to wildlife conservation efforts, what would that look like?
Well, first off, I think it's develop an appreciation for what we've got. So it's stop the noise. Just take a moment to get out of our own way and look and see what we've got and be grateful for it. I think there's this absence, at least in my experience, of appreciation for just how blessed we are. And in the absence of being able to clearly articulate that, it doesn't land because we're all so busy. Once we get a sense of being a part of it all and we move into the space of appreciation, it's being kind. And by that, it's, if I'm walking through the park and I'm seeing the garbage, do I pick it up? If I see a program that's looking at deforestation, how can I be kind? How can I contribute to the betterment of that? And that ties into the next right thing. You know, if it's one thing to be grateful, it's one thing to be kind, but in the absence of taking action to take care of what we care about, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. We're not going to have as much to be grateful for. So it's that continuum circle. I know it's corny and it's cliched, but it's finding ways from a place of appreciation to contribute to the betterment and the sustainability of it. I'm working on the premise that as human beings, we have this baseline integrity, which when we take a step back and we quieten the noise, we know what's right and what's wrong. And how often do we do the next right thing? How often do we take the next right step? And so building the capacity for people to see that and do that is where I focus.
Yeah, it's just incredible. It's incredible, Paul. Thank you. How can people find you, follow you? What are your handles? What's your website?
Probably paultemplar.com is my website. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Awesome. I am so grateful for your time and just your capacity for storytelling. And I just am really honored to have spoken with you today. So thank you for joining us.
The pleasure and privilege is all mine. Thank you so much for inviting me to come and speak with you today.
Well, listeners, I am taking a moment just to collect myself from what was a phenomenal interview. And the quote I had picked out today is an interesting one. And I loved that Paul was talking about how when people go on safari and they go into the wild, it brings us back together. It brings us back to this realization that we are so similar and we're so all just animals in the world, and it quiets us and softens us and brings us down to this place of peace. I was talking with my son the other day about wildlife conservation, and he had this quote, and it was so great that I decided I wanted to use it for the podcast. So I'm going to leave you with his quote today. He said, "We all breathe the same air." And I think that's really true and is so prevalent in the interview today. So be sure to join us next week, and thank you for listening. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge. If you like what you hear, don't forget to give us that 5-star rating and that nice review so we can bring you more of it.